Good afternoon. I'd like to call the House Labor and Commerce Committee to order. Today is Friday, March 31st. Let the record reflect the time is 3:18 p.m. Today we have President Representative Prox, Representative Wright, Representative Carrick, and myself, Chair Sumner. The staff will be assisting us today are Jordan Wright with House Records, Zachary Lawhorn with the LIO, and Clark Bickford, my staff and committee aide to House Labor and Commerce. On today's agenda, we're going to start by hearing testimony from three governor's appointees to boards and commissions. Then we'll have a first bill hearing on HB 119 and HB 92. After that, we'll have public testimony on HB 17 from Representative Carrick. Finally, we'll discuss HB 93, a bill we set an amendment deadline for 2 weeks ago and received no amendments. So starting with Jennifer McConnell, please put your name on the record, introduce yourself to the committee, and tell us why you want to serve on the Alaska Labor Relations Board.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Jennifer McConnell, Alaska Labor Relations Board, management seat.
Okay. Anybody have any questions for Mrs. McConnell? Go ahead, Mrs. McConnell.
Thank you. So I want to thank you for your time today. I was recently appointed by Governor Dunleavy to the Alaska Labor Relations Board management seat. I have over 10 years of HR and labor relations experience. My experience is in both public and private sector, as well as urban and rural Alaska. My career began as a paralegal and progressed into an HR professional. I currently work in HR at Providence Health System, supporting, in partnership with my three coworkers, six Providence facilities in Alaska. As you can see from my resume, my experience spans many components of labor relations, from union organizing and election certification to contract interpretation and negotiation. My background, coupled with my experience working with all levels of leadership across various organizations, demonstrate I have the knowledge and ability to provide informed, trusted, and fair oversight and input at the Alaska Labor Relations Agency. And thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mrs. McConnell. Are there any questions? No, I see none. We will open public testimony on Ms. McConnell's appointment. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify? Doesn't appear so. And I see no one online, so we will close public testimony. Thank you. Moving on to Cheryl Markwood. Please put your name on the record, Mrs. Markwood. Introduce yourself to the committee and tell us why you want to serve again on the Real Estate Commission.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Chairman Sumner and members of the committee. My name is Cheryl Markwood, and I am requesting confirmation for the Real Estate Commission. For those of you that do not know me, I've been a real estate since 2010, and I specialize in property management, specifically condo association management. I've owned and operated my own real estate brokerage here in the Fairbanks North Star Borough since 2015. As you know, the real estate industry plays a very important role in the Alaska economy, and the housing needs are vital priorities for Alaskans. I believe as a real estate agent, we are bound to the highest of ethical standards in serving our communities. And as a commissioner, we help to ensure that licensing standards are set to protect the public, as well as provide assurances that our industry functions with the highest standards possible. I was appointed to the Real Estate Commission in 2019, and I've served in that capacity since then. If appointed again, I will continue to serve, and I'm honored to continue serving because I believe I'm a great asset to the commission and have the historical experience given I'm the most senior member of the commission at this time. And during the last 4 years, we have accomplished some very ambitious tasks despite the COVID pandemic. I'm really proud to serve in this industry. And I recognize the value the real estate industry plays in the state's economy. So, in closing, it would just be an honor to continue serving and a privilege to provide the commitment and serve the state of Alaska as a real estate commissioner. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Mrs. Markwood, and I'm proud to have had the pleasure to serve with you on the Real Estate Commission. We will now open public testimony on Mrs. Markwood's appointment. Is there anybody in the room that wishes to testify on this appointment? Okay, see none. There's no one online. We will close public testimony. Moving on to House Bill 119, Heath Hilliard. Oh, hang on. Mrs. Markwood, we have a question from Representative Carrick.
Thank you, through the chair. Ms. Markwood, I just wanted to say thank you for stepping up to serve again. And I also understand you're from West Fairbanks in my district, so also thank you for representing our region as well. And I just had a brief question for you, which is just how have some of the dynamics in the field of real estate changed in your tenure, and what do you foresee as some of the major challenges for the commission going forward in this next appointment?
So our industry has rapidly changed over the last 10 years, probably, given the computer and so much Zoom. We see a great deal of out-of-state companies trying to move into the Alaska industry remotely. So licensing plays a very important role in that. We've also seen a huge impact in VRBO and Airbnb in the industry, and that has played a huge impact on housing. So there are a lot of items that are going to be addressed here in the coming years in licensing specifically. And then there's also, because I specialize in property management, one of my special fields that I've really kind of paid close attention to has been property management, landlord-tenant law, and making sure that as licensees we are equipped to provide the very best service to the public. So,
thank you.
I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mrs. Markwood. And let the record reflect that Representative Ruffridge joined us at 3:22 p.m. Vice Chair Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Chair Sumner. In accordance with AS 39.05.080, the Labor and Commerce Committee held a hearing on the following appointees: Cheryl Markwood with the Real Estate Commission and Jennifer McConnell with the Alaska Labor Relations Agency, and move those individuals forward for a hearing with the full body. The signature on this report does not reflect an intent by any of the members to vote for or against the confirmation of either of these individuals during any further sessions.
Thank you, Vice Chair Ruffridge. Okay, moving on to House Bill 119. Heath Hilliard, Chief of Staff for Speaker Tilton, is here to present the bill. Please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation. And I understand this is a brief overview of the bill with an opportunity for committee members to ask questions. Jana Welson, attorney and task force co-chair, is online, as well as Brandon Emmett, task force co-chair, Joan Wilson, director of AMCO, and Claire Radford, the drafting attorney from LAA Legal. Go ahead, Mr. Hilliard.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Heath Hilliard, Chief of Staff to Speaker Tilton, and I appreciate the opportunity to pinch hit for your staff, Mr. Logan, on this bill. He and I have been working together on this bill and 117 as well. Before I get into sort of the meat of the presentation and the sectional, the walkthrough of the sectional, I need to give the committee a little context for how these bills came to be about. Shortly after the beginning of session and after organizing, the governor's legislative office came to the speaker's office and said, you know, we had the governor's marijuana task force that had a report that they've issued with a series of, I think, 15 or 16 recommendations. Department of Law just didn't have the bandwidth to actually draft a bill themselves, and so we're asking if Speaker's office and the House majority would be willing to sort of take that responsibility, which we did. Originally, we intended to introduce a singular bill that encapsulated every single one of the recommendations from the task force. However, drafting ended up being much longer than we anticipated. And so with the goal of assisting the industry and the task force with getting at least some of these recommendations enacted this year, we chose to separate out two different bills. So what you're seeing currently in 119 as the bill sits before you is also included in 117. But 117, as you know, Mr. Chair, is going through a substantial rewrite before the committee sees it. So we chose to extract the taxation portions of the master bill and make that its own standalone. And so that's what we're presenting today. Also keep in mind that, again, the Speaker's office in effectuating the drafting, we were not participants in the task force. So with regard to the rationale and arguments for various sections of the bill, I'm going to defer to Mr. Emmett. I believe he's going to be the primary online today to respond to questions that you may have. And I'm going to walk through the bill as it stands before you, but I will try to acknowledge that there are sections that the task force has subsequently come back to us with to say, we either need to amend this or remove this, and I'll kind of allude to that, but I will again defer to Mr. Emmett to be the one to primarily answer those questions. So with that, I will just walk through the sectional analysis very briefly. Ultimately, the one thing, and I think I'm not misspeaking, one of the primary reasons for this bill and for the taxation provisions is that the industry, the legal recreational industry, is attempting to remain reasonably competitive with the black market, which anecdotal evidence has suggested to me that a substantial portion of marijuana that's grown and consumed in Alaska is actually not taxed because it's actually being bought and sold in the black market. I will let the industry expert defer to that, and Ms. Wilson and AMCO, but that's kind of the primary emphasis is my understanding. So with that, again, I'll walk through the sectional. Number one, not most important, but immediately the bill proposes to reduce the excise tax, the $50 per ounce excise tax at the cultivator level down to $12.50. For a period of 5 years right now, and the reason it's a five-year period, my understanding was, is originally Department of Revenue felt that it might take up to 5 years to stand up a new retail sales tax, which is ultimately what this bill transitions to. So Section 1 really just drops the rate from $50 an ounce to $12.50 an ounce. Section 2, which I believe is intended to either be amended or removed, was stating that other parts of the plant, such as trim, seed, stems, could be either not taxed at all or taxed at a rate lower than $12.50. Section 3 dictates how the marijuana tax revenue can be appropriated and spent by the legislature and where it must go. Section directs all marijuana tax revenue to the Marijuana Education and Treatment Fund and interest earned. The legislature, has the ability to appropriate either to the Department of Health for the program or the Department of Commerce and Community Affairs or the General Fund. Section 4 establishes the 3% retail sales tax at the retailer level. Section 5 establishes monthly statements for those retailers as they start to collect the sales tax in 2028. I believe Section 6 is largely clarifying language with regard to the definition of a cultivation facility. Oh, no, I'm sorry. Replaces cultivation facility with retail marijuana store. That's where the transition is from the cultivator to the retail store. Section 7, the Recidivism Reduction Fund is repealed. Now, my understanding, again, talking with Ms. Wilcox is in the audience, and I believe Mr. Emmett said that this recommendation has been amended and that they believe they intend to remove that section. So the Recidivism Reduction Fund would not be repealed and it would be left alone. Section 8 repeals the excise tax in total once the retail sales tax is fully in effect. And Section 10, 4 through 6, gives us the effective dates just to conform with the dates of the establishment of the retail tax. And so with that, I would like to defer primarily, I think, to Mr. Emmett for questions from the committee about the rationale behind the various recommendations that are contained in the bill.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hilliard. Mr. Emmett, are you on?
Hello. Thank you, Mr. Hilliard. Good day, Chief Sumner, Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Brandon Emmett, co-chair of the Governor's Tax Task Force, and I am available to answer any questions that you may have.
Okay, do any Representative Prox?
Yes, thank you. Through the chair, I guess when I voted yes on the referendum to create or to decriminalize marijuana, it wasn't that I was real happy about marijuana, but I wasn't happy about the black market. And has anyone analyzed how this will affect the potential for a black market in marijuana? In other words, one of the arguments I hear is that the tax is so high that it encourages a black market. Underground market, I suppose, is the right word.
And through the chair, Representative Prax, again, before I defer back to Mr. Emmett, that's my understanding. My understanding is that also in the process of the task force meeting attempting to do their work, that they were not privy to sophisticated modeling from Department of Revenue, which I think Department of Revenue is now in a better situation to be able to provide this committee or subsequent committees with some of the modeling that could answer your question. So with that, I'll defer to Mr. Emmett.
Thank you. Through the chair, to answer your question, Representative, we do not have hard data that shows exactly how much of the industry is still controlled by the black market, but all of the anecdotal evidence that we can find surveying customers, talking with other cultivators, retailers, and just seeing the vast amount of untaxed, unregulated marijuana that is sold online, we think that the black market may be as high as 45% of the marijuana industry. And the task force request to reduce the excise tax, to remove that immobile price floor that prevents the sale price of marijuana from becoming low enough to truly compete with the black market, we think is fairly accurate, although we do not have a strong model to build that off of. I can tell you from my own personal experience, just in talking with our customers, I'm a vertically integrated marijuana licensee, that people can find marijuana that's untaxed, untested for approximately half the price of what many of our colleagues sell it for. And so I think that the threat to the legitimate industry by the black market is real, and that the way for the legitimate market to be truly competitive is through economic principles, and we feel that this will help accomplish that goal.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Carrick.
Thank you. Through the chair, I'm looking at Section 3, and I'm seeing that we're changing the fund revenue from the Department of Health for Comprehensive Marijuana Education and Treatment to these three sources, including some back into the industry to help grow the industry, is my guess, with the DCCED funds, and then some to the general fund. And I'm curious about the general fund designation there for some of those funds, if the sponsor staff could maybe elaborate why those two additional fund.
And through the chair, Representative Carrick, again, that was not an intentional policy decision on behalf of the speaker or the rules by committee. Mm-hmm. That was simply reflective based entirely on the task force's report with regard to taxation. So we made no direction or policy decision on behalf of them. We simply asked that to be drafted to the recommendations in the task force report.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
So through the chair, is there I guess, is there potentially merit in just limiting those funds to exclusively the Department of Health and DCCED, as opposed to also further splintering those appropriations into the general fund as well.
Through the chair, Representative Carrick, on behalf of Speaker Tilton and the Rules Committee, that would be a policy call for this committee. I think in terms of getting to the root of the question for you, really would need to be directed toward Mr. Emmett because they were the ones that made the recommendation.
If we could ask that question of Mr. Emmett.
Mr. Emmett, if you heard that question.
I did. And through the chair, when the task force was analyzing the way that the funds were being allocated, we felt that the funding may be better spent with a greater allocation to health versus the recidivism reduction fund, although I don't think the task force was working with quite as much information as we had now, and so we would be amicable to it being unchanged. We do support the increase in funds going to the Department of Health, but no, that's not something that we necessarily hanging our hat on either.
Representative Prox.
Thank you. Through the chair, that raises another concern. That did somebody discuss the constitutionality of dedicating a tax to any specific thing?
Maybe I could address that. Representative Prox, of course, would just be intent language. You cannot designate revenue streams. I mean, we could get an answer from legal, but I'm certain that is the answer.
Okay, I'll check that out. Thank you.
But Mr. Emmett, if you have an opinion on that?
Through the chair, I feel that the power of appropriation is indeed yours, and that the task force does not have a strong opinion in the matter.
Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. I just had a question on the excise tax portion. So it seems like a significant reduction in the excise tax from $50 per ounce to $12.50. Can you tell me a little bit more about if we're imposing a sales tax? That seems new. I don't think that exists currently. What's the purpose behind taxing sort of at every step? Should we just pick a tax and stay with it? What was the purpose of the excise tax to begin with?
Through the chair, we felt that having a stepwise system for altering the tax structure would be the most appropriate because it would ultimately be the simplest to change the excise tax first to give immediate relief to the cultivation sector of the industry, but then the intent would be to change over from a weight-based excise tax to a retail tax. And we feel that ultimately the marijuana retailers are best suited to collect those taxes. One, because the nature of their business has a steadier revenue stream, and two, because many or all of the municipalities already require a retail tax on marijuana. And so there would be a transition period between the flat excise tax and then a date set where it would become a tax at retail and the marijuana excise tax would no longer exist.
Representative Ruffridge.
Just a follow-up to that. I don't seem to see that and maybe I missed it. Obviously, this is the introduction for it. But is that language in this bill? Is that what Section 8 is, to repeal it by 2028? Is that the intention there?
Through the chair, Representative Ruffridge, yes.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay. Seeing no other questions, we will set HB 119 aside for a future date. Moving on to public testimony for HB 7. Thank you, Mr. Hilliard. Moving on to public testimony for HB 17 from Representative Carrick. I'm going to open public testimony. Please remember to keep your testimony to 3 minutes. Is there anyone in the room who wishes to testify? First come, first serve. Please put your name on the record and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. For the record, my name is Morgan Lim, and today I'm testifying on behalf of Planned Parenthood Alliance Advocates Alaska. PPAA is in strong support of House Bill 17. We all deserve affordable and accessible birth control that works for us, regardless of our income, insurance carrier, or life circumstances. Consistent access to birth control gives people the ability to control when and if they have children, giving them more career and education opportunities, encouraging healthier pregnancies, and saving on healthcare spending. That is why 83% of voters in Alaska believe everyone who wants or needs birth control should have it. This bill would have a huge impact for patients in our very rural state, people without reliable access to transportation, or who live in rural areas have more barriers to dependable access to birth control, making it more likely that they will experience an unintended pregnancy. 1 in 4 women say that they have missed pills because they could not get their next pack in time. While hormonal birth control is over 95% effective with perfect use, monthly trips to the pharmacy can make perfect use difficult or impossible for many people, especially those with lower incomes or who live in rural communities. Access to an extended supply of contraception is particularly important for people who work multiple jobs or have low income. Extended supply also helps people who face additional barriers to contraceptive care, including young people or survivors of intimate partner violence or reproductive coercion who may not want their abuser to know they are using contraceptives. Seeing the vast health and economic benefits, 22 states in the District of Columbia have already enacted policies requiring insurance to cover an extended supply of contraception. The evidence from these states clearly shows that covering an extended supply of birth control decreases unintended pregnancies, the need for abortion services, and is cost effective. One study found that providing a 12-month supply of birth control decreased unintended pregnancies by 30%. Compared with a supply of just 1 or 3 months. The same study found that giving a woman a year's supply of birth control reduced the odds of those women obtaining an abortion by 46%. And research from the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs found that covering an extended supply of birth control resulted in substantial cost savings for the department and a reduction in unintended pregnancy. Thank you for holding a hearing on this important bill. By taking steps to improve birth control access, we can reduce barriers to contraceptives, help people in Alaska plan their families and avoid unintended pregnancies, and save money for Alaskan families. We encourage you to support HB 17 and move it out of committee. Thank you.
Okay. Anybody else in the room wish to testify? We'll move to online testimony. We have a Caitlin Saft.
Hello, my name is Caitlin Saft, and I'm testifying on behalf of myself and in support of HB 17. As a woman who's lived in Alaska my whole life, I have understood the barriers of getting contraceptive care, except I live in Anchorage, so I am privileged with having ready access to multiple pharmacies. But I really can't imagine what it's like living in rural Alaska where you may not have access to every month get another pack. And in this climate of no more protection of Roe, it's of the utmost importance that we keep our protection of reproductive health and keep access to contraception and make those barriers even less so that we decrease the amount of unintended pregnancies and the need for abortion care. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mrs. Saft. We have Alyssa Quintine in Fairbanks. Go ahead, Mrs. Quintine.
Hi there. Can you hear me?
Yes. Go ahead.
All right, great. My name is Alyssa Quintine. I am a community organizer and resident here in Fairbanks, and I'm calling in support of HB 15. I wanted to tell this committee a little bit of a story since I've been testifying on this probably since I was 20. And I'm 28 now, so it's been a long time. Folks may not know, but I have what you call polycystic ovarian syndrome. And short story, it is a genetic disorder that does not make my organs work very properly. I had my first period when I was 4. No one before that or 0 after that, just 4. I was put on puberty blockers, and until I was probably 22, it was back and forth between doctors and specialists to figure out what was going on with me. They didn't really listen. They just said, oh, well, that's normal, which, you know, having a period at 4 is not normal. And with all the different symptoms that go with PCOS, none of that was normal. And I was finally diagnosed when I was 22, and I was placed on hormonal birth control. And ever since then, all of my symptoms, to include like years, you know, of nothing but a period, years of never having a period and not knowing why, having cramps so painful that it was comparable to labor and I was not pregnant, to just almost hemorrhaging out and the ER not being able to do anything, that was pretty severe. So bills like this really do protect women and girls and femmes who, you know, have disorders like this. And there's been many occasions where a pharmacy has ran out, or I've had I forget what you call them, but the people behind the counter say, well, I don't want to give you your birth control because, you know, I don't believe in abortions, and I don't believe in, you know, people using birth control as abortions. And it has nothing to do with that. It is gender-affirming care, and birth control is health care, especially for women that have genetic disorders, and you know, that's life-saving. And so, you know, for me here in Fairbanks, yeah, I can go to Walmart, I can go to Fred Meyer's, get it, and probably not have a problem. But, you know, for folks that have to fly or drive in to get their medication, in the off chance that you deal with a person behind the counter that knows nothing about you but doesn't think you deserve that medication, something like this that makes insurance companies be less greedy and give us our life-saving medication that we need is essentially life-saving for a lot of people. And it's about time that the legislature passed this, because this is better for your constituents. This is better for providers that have to deal with filling those orders every single month. And it's better for the tellers that are really just trying to do their job and get the medication out. So I really hope that you pass this out of committee. I really want to see this pass the session, so the next time I go to the pharmacy, I can get them 12 packs, live my life, and do what I need to do. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mrs. Quinton. Next, we have Pamela Samish from Nanana. Go ahead.
Hi. Yeah, thank you for taking our testimony today. My name is Pam Samish, and I do live in a rural community of Nanana. I would like to encourage you to vote no on 17. First of all, when I was listening to the testimonies, Planned Parenthood's answer to sexual abuse is a year's supply of birth control. That's interesting. Okay. Anyway, I want to say that as a rural person, I can get birth control anytime through telehealth. There is no risk to rural people getting birth control. So that's totally bogus. Okay. I can call telehealth and get birth control all day long. No big deal. Okay. So let's not make believe that this is some necessary bill, because it's not. Okay. Birth control can be dangerous. Okay. I took it for 3 months. I got 12 lumps in my breast, and it took me 2 years to get rid of them. Okay. You have to see a doctor, because you can get blood clots, breast cancer, and heart issues, among many other things, from birth control pills. It is, you, by doing this, you're making the doctor liable. If he gives a woman a year's birth control and she dies from blood clots, he has to live with that guilt for the rest of his life. A young woman, okay? So this is deadly to women, okay? That's why this law is in place, is to protect women, which I thought Planned Parenthood cared about, but apparently not. Okay, I'll let that go before you cut me off. Birth control does allow the release of an egg, which can be fertilized, and it is a method of abortion, because that is a person at the moment of conception, and that's been proved scientifically. And finally, this type of bill has happened before. I know some of you are new. I've been down this road before with the legislation. This, all this is a way to get Native people to stop having babies. This is a Native bill. Anytime they say rural, they mean Native, okay? So the point of this is to slow down Native people from having children. This is a discriminatory bill. It's a dangerous bill, and I'm pleased asking you to vote no on it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mrs. Samish. Next, we have Rose O'Hara Jolie in Anchorage. Mrs. O'Hara Jolie, go ahead, if you can hear me.
Yes. Hello and good morning. My name is Rose O'Hara Jolie, and I currently live in Anchorage. I am here in support of HB 17. Some of you have heard my story before, but I'm passionate about being able to work and live in Alaska, and I hope my taking the time to testify can help the committee to better understand how this bill can easily improve the lives and ability of people, especially women in Alaska, to work. When I first moved to Alaska, I lived outside of Cantwell, so yes, I've spent the majority of my time in the state as a rural resident, and in the summer, I worked construction. In summer construction, you work to get the job done before the snow hits. There is no standard five-day week. While there, I started to have health issues. I was lucky enough to get a day off to drive to Fairbanks, where I learned I was experiencing perimenopause. Ideally, I would be able to go to a compound pharmacist, but that was not an option living in the interior. So already unable to obtain the best care possible, my doctor suggested going on oral birth control to replace the hormones my body was no longer making. I want to address that this bill does not change what a doctor finds best for you. Given my medical history, a doctor knew that going on oral contraceptions for the summer months without a revisit was perfectly healthy, and that was a decision my doctor made to address the complications from the previous caller. We all have different medical histories, and that's why doctors and not insurance companies should be making these decisions. After going to the doctor, I went to the Fred Meyers on my way out of town. To my surprise, I was only allowed 1 month's supply. Holding a year-long prescription in my hand, I tried to explain to the pharmacist that I lived hundreds of miles away and would not be able to take time off work and return each month. There was nothing he could do. I got in my car to do the turn and burn back to Cantwell, crying almost the entire way. After a month of being on the medication, it was clearly working, but I had no way to get to Fairbanks to fill my prescription. I ended up having to confide in my boss. No one should have to tell their boss their medical information. And each month, I missed a day of work that my male colleagues did not. Over the course of that summer, I lost over $800 in missed wages and gas alone, not to mention wear on my borrowed car and time wasted driving to get a prescription simply because insurance companies and politicians had denied me access. And I was lucky. My boss is compassionate, and at that point, I was on the road system. Many others live off the road or work on fishing ships or on fires protecting us all summer and cannot access a pharmacy. Without migration the state is facing, 50% of the workforce should not be potentially denied access to needed medication. And I want to address the telehealth issue. I still lived 30 minutes from the post office, and that post office had a wait list for a box. So that was not an option for me, not to mention the fact that during the winter, often the mail would be delayed, and when I lived off the road system, the mail was delayed most of the time. During the winter weather. So I hope that you'll pass HB 17, a simple, necessary, and equitable bill. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mrs. O'Hara Jolly. Next, we have Olivia Lynn in Fairbanks. Mrs. Lynn, go ahead.
Hello, my name is Olivia Lynn. I'm from Fairbanks. I've lived here my whole life, and I'm calling in support of House Bill 17. For me, birth control is a necessity to be competitive in my line of work. As a single childless union journeyman electrician, 1547, I'm expected to always be ready to work, and it's always noticed when I'm not performing as well as everyone else. Without birth control, once a month, my performance would dive while I was managing my symptoms, everything from cramps to bleeding to headaches, overall soreness, everything. with birth control, I only have to deal with this every 3 months, which gives me the leverage to schedule that time off to deal with the worst of the symptoms in the comfort of my home, as well as not receive any backlash from my management for poor performance during that time. Always noticed. Everyone in Alaska deserves the chance to become more competitive in their field, to make more money, and raise their standard of living. Consistent access to birth control is essential to making sure everyone has that opportunity. This is why I hope you pass this bill out of the committee. Thank you for hearing my story.
Thank you, Mrs. Lynn. Next, we have Ed Martin from Kenai. Mr. Martin, if you can hear me, go ahead.
Yes, Chairman Sumner, and to my representative, Justin. First, I'd like to make a statement about who will vote on this and who won't. And I believe that, Justin, regardless of your position on the committee, you should claim a conflict of interest, as it may pertain to you making money off of a future sale for which this bill would support. Now, let's get to the moral issue of this. You know, I'm 68 years old, and I can tell you right now that my wife, when we first got married, was on a contraceptive thing and ended up with her getting sick. It's affected many women, and it's not indiscriminatory in that fact. I believe that this doesn't aid in the benefit of human health, or female health, should we say. And the benefit on the other side is we actually will give birth to more children in a country for which abortion has taken 60 million out of the populace. And I don't know about you guys. You're in commerce here. You should be concerned about the labor that's going to be lost from the death of children in the future. And this just legitimizes it. I do not support this bill in any form or fashion. And guess what? I'm on Social Security now. I get Medicare. In any case, this just passes the bill on to all the rest of us at higher rates. That's not appropriate either. You guys are there for the purpose of protecting my interests as a taxpayer also. So may I remind you, this is not morally right, not only in the fact of finances in my pocket, my religious beliefs, and the best health of the children that may never get born because of this. Now, search your own moral convictions before you vote on this, and please express your conflict of interest before you make a decision to vote. I thank you very much for the testimony. You folks have a good day. You got a tough one here.
Thank you, Mr. Martin. Okay, that is all we have online. Moving back to the room, is there anybody that wishes to testify on HB 17? No? Okay, we will close public testimony. We set an amendment deadline for this bill and received none. Comments on the bill from the committee members? No? Does the bill sponsor want to make a comment on the bill?
Thank you. For the record, Ashley Carrick, representative for House District 35 in West Fairbanks, and just thank you again to the House Labor and Commerce Committee for hearing and considering House Bill 17. In the public testimony, I think we heard some very impassioned stories from folks who have utilized birth control. And I just want to point out that while this bill does relate to birth control and relate to prescription contraceptive access, I just want to remind the committee members and the members of the public who testified and are listening today that this legislation does not change the relationship between a provider and the patient. In other words, Currently, providers are able to prescribe a 12-month or year-long prescription for contraceptives. What is changing with House Bill 17 is what happens when you go to the counter to pick that medication up. And mandating insurance coverage and changing that relationship with the insurer is vitally important to Alaskan women who are seeking access to contraception, especially in a state with many rural communities. We know as well, just to remind the committee, that women who are dispensed a 12-month supply of contraceptives have a 30% drop in unplanned pregnancies and a 46% drop in the likelihood of abortion compared to women dispensed a 1 to 3 month supply of contraceptives. So again, in consultation with a provider who can help make appropriate health decisions with their patients and follow up with those patients, this legislation just seeks to remove a barrier to care that many other states and federal contraceptive coverage guarantees have already affirmed. So I thank the committee for consideration, and I hope that you will continue to consider this legislation going forward.
Thank you, Representative Carrick. Vice Chair Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would move House Bill number 17, version B, also referred to as 33-LS0222/Bravo, be advanced from the committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal notes.
Okay. Without objection, House Bill 17 has been moved from committee. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the committee report, and then we'll be right back with Representative Vance. Now for first bill hearing with on House Bill 92 from the Fisheries Committee. Representative Vance, please approach the committee, put your name on the record, and begin your presentation.
At ease, Mr. Chairman.
Brief at ease. Okay, we're back on the record. Representative Vance.
Thank you, Chairman Sumner and members of the House Labor and Commerce Committee. For the record, this is Representative Sarah Vance of House District 6.
Thank you. For the record, Jake Almeida, Representative Vance's Chief of Staff.
Members of the committee, this bill comes at the request of the Department of Labor and Workforce Development. House Bill 92 increases the vessel owner deductible reimbursement up to $15,000 to provide equity between both crew members and vessel owners. The purpose of this bill is to establish equity. The vessel owners and crew members will receive the same reimbursement. It also provides a potential cost savings, resulting in the members possibly paying less in protection and indemnity insurance premiums and protection of loss. It may help them protect against loss due to medical and legal claims. This bill specifically is regarding the Fisherman's Fund. Established in 1951, the fund provides for the treatment and care of Alaska-licensed commercial fishermen who have been injured while fishing onshore and offshore in Alaska. Benefits from the fund are financed from revenue received from each resident and non-resident commercial fisherman's license and permit fee. The Fisherman's Fund is currently offering a $15,000 benefit to crew members, but a $5,000 benefit to vessel owners. Even though both groups contribute to the fund at the same rate, $50 annually collected through crew licenses and commercial fishing permits. This change would provide equity between the two groups. And my apologies, that is $10,000 benefit to crew members and $5,000. We have increased both of those to be the same under this bill. An increase in the deductible provides a cost savings opportunity to allow the vessel owners to pay less in premiums for the P&I insurance. Commercial fishermen are not currently covered under workman's compensation. And if a crew member is injured beyond the $15,000 worth of medical bills and the vessel owner does not have P&I insurance, the vessel owner is at risk of losing their vessel to satisfy medical or legal claims. So we asked the department to look at the fund and give us the worst and the best case scenario on impacts to the fund by increasing this to $15,000. So they provided a couple of scenarios, and you see the numbers indicated there. So this is the worst case scenario over time. And then we have the best case scenario using a 9-year average. And as you can see, by increasing the average at $15,000, it keeps the fund stable with the small increases over time. In conversations about with the fund managers, they believe that this projection is going to be more accurate based upon the claims and the health of the fund over time. As I mentioned before, there is inequity between the current benefit between the vessel owners and crew members. And what House Bill 92 establishes is equity at $15,000 to bring that up to vote. So in short, this bill is just utilizing the Fisherman's Fund for precisely what it was intended to do, to help commercial fishermen. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Representative Vance. Let's see. Would you like to do your invited testimony at this time, or?
Yes, Mr. Chairman. They can speak to the fund and make themselves available to questions. I'm not sure if they had a prepared testimony.
Okay. Well, we have a Velma Thomas and a Charles Collins in the room. Mrs. Thomas or Mr. Collins, would you like to speak to the bill?
To the chair and the committee, I just want to thank Representative Vance and staff member Almeida and also Ms. Aki for their help in helping us move this forward. The bill is being brought forward to the committee based upon the resolution from the Fisherman's Fund Council. And the council members are very active. They represent the state of Alaska up from Nome to Dillingham area through the Gulf and down through Juneau and Wrangell, Sitka, Petersburg. So we're here to answer any questions that you might have.
Any questions? Representative Kerr.
Thank you, through the chair. I'm curious, this bill does not currently have a fiscal note. What would be some of the impacts to the fund over time with these changes? It looks like we're increasing both for crew members and vessel owners. So I'm just curious what some of the fiscal impacts could be.
Through the chair, Charles Collins, Director of Workers' Compensation. So Velma acts as our actuary. We've had several goes at this, and we feel that the chart that is before you up there right now with yellow is most reflective of forecasting future. So let me just walk you through this. What we've done is we looked backwards 9 years and took all the claims. 80% of the claims that were turned in were less than $2,500 each, and 20% of them would have risen to the max that was allowed to be paid out, either the $5,000 or the $10,000, depending on whether it was a crew member or a vessel owner. I then took the 80% forward for the 9 years, and the 20% we maxed out to what the maximum would be. Adding the revenue that comes in between permits and the licensing fees every year, staying static, and while at that, it's not reflected on this chart, at that very conservative, shall we say, look, the fund still stays over $8 million 9 years out. So we could if we maxed it out, we could go backwards a little bit over 9 years. But the fund has been here since 1951. It predates statehood, and our job is to watch over it, and that's what Velma's here for. So, thank you.
Follow up.
Representative Kerr.
Thank you, through the chair. And I just don't have a ton of familiarity with the fund itself. So are there any other utilizations of the fund currently besides the structure that's currently in place?
So through the chair, Representative Carrick, statute allows money from the fund to be allocated by the legislature for fishermen safety programs. Has not been done in our memory. In fact, we can't see where it's ever been done in the 71 years it's been together, 72 years almost now. That is the only use. This is the epitome of a user group funding themselves, allowing the state to monitor those funds so that they are done fairly by all. Our Fish Fund Advisory Council does an excellent job overseeing the claims that come in, and they self-govern themselves. And past legislatures have recognized the operations as being done properly and just allowed it to work. So.
Thank you. Representative Ruffridge.
Thank you, Chair Sumner. Through the chair, thank you for just a brief description of the Fisherman's Fund. I, like Representative Carrick, relatively unfamiliar with this, but does this operate then, I assume, since you're from the Workman's Comp group, that it operates very similar to Workman's Comp, but maybe I'm not so sure on that. So if a fisherman is injured and they go seek treatment, do they have to pay up front, or is it a form that they fill out, like at a physician's office, for example, knowing that the Fisherman's Fund will cover it and there's no charges exerted on site, similar to other workman's comp claims?
Through the chair, so let me start this, and then I'll let Velma walk you through how it works. So one thing we want to clarify immediately, commercial fishermen do not qualify for workers' compensation. It's completely covered under the Jones Act. It's part of federal government, workers' comp in the state of Alaska or any other state. Has no jurisdiction whatsoever there. The Fisherman's Fund is placed in workers' compensation because it is a like program, but it is separate completely. No funds are ever commingled out of the Fisherman's Fund. That money all goes through the process of Fisherman's Fund, and I'll let Velma Thomas walk you through how a claim works.
Thank you. So, as Director Collins mentioned, injured fishermen, their remedies are limited. They can either file a claim for benefits to get help through the Fisherman's Fund, or they can seek to get medical assistance through the Jones Act. And that's mainly a maintenance and cure. Basically, that means medical and lost wages or any other, you know, pain and suffering, so they can seek that route. The fund only pays for medical benefits. We don't pay for any lost wages. They must file a claim to get benefits. And also for the vessel owner portion, so there's two types of benefits. There's a benefit available to the injured fisherman, and then there's a benefit available to the vessel owner that if they have the protection and indemnity insurance in place to cover their crew members, they can get reimbursed if the insurance carrier picks up the payment. They can get reimbursed for a portion of their deductible.
Any other questions? No. Actually, I have a question. Given the age of the fund, is this might actually be a designated fund. Is that the case?
I'll answer that. I'm sorry, I should introduce myself properly. Velma Thomas, Program Coordinator. And I am the fund administrator, and I do administrator two other similar funds. They're focused toward the injured worker. the fund predates statehood, and as far as I know, it has always been a designated fund.
Yeah. And when was the last time an adjustment on the payouts was made? Do you know?
Yes. 2018, we did come and request an increase on the vessel owner portion. It was originally $2,500, and we were asked to increase that to $5,000. And there was also a limit. It was either $2,500 or 50%, whichever was less. So in 2018, that portion was increased. In 2010, the injured worker benefit portion went from $2,500 to $10,000. And we were expecting to see perhaps a big increase in expenses, and we didn't. And there could be a couple of reasons why. During that time, from 2014 to now, the Affordable Health Care Act went into place. So the Fisherman Fund is a medical fund, but primarily if someone has insurance, we can step into a secondary payer position. So a person can decide to go ahead and get treatment, as you said, and then file a claim to get reimbursed by the fund. Or at that time, they can, most of the medical providers in Alaska know about the fund, I would say the big ones, and they have our claim packets. They're able to assist an injured fisherman when they go in. They pretty much have everything, have them fill it out, and then submit the claim to the fund. And then we can, as long as we get the bills and they meet the criteria for qualifying, we could go ahead and start paying right away. Or someone can go ahead and get treatment, use their personal insurance, and then we can help with the expenses on the portion that they have to pay. So, and I think those things have contributed to the health of the fund over the last couple of years, that more folks have had personal insurance and we have paid the 20% as opposed to the 80% of their medical expenses. But that is just my opinion.
Representative Frox.
Yes. Thank you. Through the chair, interesting idea. This seems to be covering, potentially covering the deductible on a high deductible insurance policy. And interesting idea. But to, for this bill, two questions, I guess. First, should we have a fiscal note just as a matter of policy and procedure for bills? Because it does seem to affect the fund.
Through the chair, the department issued a zero fiscal note on it because there is no cost to our budget.
To the department. Okay, thank you. I knew that.
And indeed, Representative Frox, this is a actual designated fund and is not even available, I don't believe, for UGF.
Probably not, since it was established before statehood. And then the other question, is everybody happy? Because we're increasing the benefit for the vessel owners, and that increased burden is somehow going to be paid by everybody when you set the rates.
Through the chair, Representative Prox, the fishing associations, UFA, and HET are behind us. Our Fish Fund Advisory Council had wanted to move it to $10,000. The Fisheries Committee of the House went to $15,000 because they felt that that would incentivize the industry even further. So as Ms. Thomas stated, if a vessel owner has P&I insurance, and there is an incident, and there's a claim against the vessel, the fund, they can apply to the fund to have that deductible portion done. The push from the industry has been that this P&I insurance, along with everything else, has increased considerably in expense, and to you know, save on expenses. Quite often they wanted to raise their deductible. So they went from $2,500 to $5,000, and now they, you know, quite a few of them are going to $10,000. We're giving them wiggle room to $15,000. I am not sure how that will play out, but what I can tell you is that we feel like the fund is healthy enough to take care of that. The council is very careful and always been very cognizant of the fact that they are working with a limited group of people that are a very close-knit community and tend to take care of each other. And the division in the entire Department of Labor is cognizant of the fact that the Fisherman's Fund is one of our shining examples of success in this state, and we have taken it very serious to keep it that way. So.
Yeah, just a comment that does seem to be working, and legislators don't like to see things that are working continue to work. So we want to get involved. I'm trying to figure out how.
I have no comment on that. Thank you.
Representative Ruffridge?
Do you have a comment on that?
Yeah, I'm scared to ask a question now. through the chair, it's interesting to have the part of the bill where heart attack is sort of specified out there. What was the reason for that? So I'm assuming, you know, we have a lot of very remote fishing grounds. If someone has a heart attack, there's a large cost in some cases to transport them and things. How often does that happen? One, two, should that be a higher dollar amount in your opinion?
Through the chair to Representative Ruffridge. Over the last 5 years, I believe we may have had two claims. And the claims that we do get don't necessarily meet the qualifying criteria for Fisherman's Fund. They have to present a valid fishing license. And in this case, I believe we received the claim information. The expense probably have hit about $200,000, but the individual never did supply a valid commercial fishing license. They may have been fishing. They may have been sport fishing. So that's probably why the claim didn't proceed. But I don't think that we would see a significant effect.
Okay, thank you.
On expenses.
Through the chair, just a side note on that, there's no change in the verbiage of the bill other than that $15,000. The heart attack has been in there since, I think, 1977, if I recall.
Okay. Well, thank you, Mrs. Thomas. Thank you, Mr. Collins. Thank you to the bill sponsor, Representative Vance. We will set this bill aside for public testimony, and we will notice an amendment deadline. I believe rules has requested we not notice public testimony for next week, so I think we will do this for the week following. Thank you. Moving on to our last bill, HB 93, we set an amendment deadline for this and received no amendments. If anybody has any questions about this bill, Jeremy Cross from Department of Forestry is online. Are there any questions? No? Okay. Well, seeing no questions, Vice Chair Ruffridge, what's the will of the committee?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I move House Bill Number 93, version A, also referred to as 33-LS0553/alpha, be advanced from the committee with individual recommendations and the attached fiscal note.
Okay, without objection, House Bill 93 has been advanced from committee. This concludes our business today. Seeing no other business before the committee, we will adjourn. Let the record reflect the time is 4:30 p.m.